This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. The statistics about sexual assault on college campuses are staggering. One in five women is assaulted during her time on campus, and the vast majority of these assaults go unreported. Title IX advocates and assault survivors around the country have pushed to bring the issues to the forefront, and in the past few years, universities have faced increased pressure to better support students' needs. My guest today knows these dynamics all too well. She spent more than a decade as a federal sex crimes prosecutor in Washington, D.C., and now has turned to fiction to process what she saw in the courtroom. Her latest novel, in a series about a fictional prosecutor, looks at the complicated dynamics of sexual assault on campus and the individuals and families involved. She's going to be reading from her book, The Last Good Girl, in Cary tonight, but first joins me in the studio, Allison Liotta. Welcome back to the State of Things.
Hi.
Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me back, Frank.
This is the fifth book in your series about prosecutor Anna Curtis. Tell us about why you chose this topic, because she's taken on a number of crimes. Why this one and why now?
Sure. Well, I should also say they're all standalones, so you can read The Last Good Girl without having read the others. But really the question is, why wait until now? It's such a huge issue. It's such an important topic. I'm always looking for what is outrageous, and that's usually a good thing to put a novel on. So my editor and I said, now's the time. And my editor, she's always right. So
you could write a solid, I mean, you were prosecuting these crimes. This was your day job in Washington before you turned to writing. Why not write nonfiction? Why a novel?
I think sometimes a novel can tell a better story, can tell more of the truth about what's out there than any one individual story could. And what I tried to do in The Last Good Girl was take a lot of the most interesting pieces from different stories around the country and put them in here so that someone reading it would not only get an entertaining story, but get a feel for what is happening out in college campuses across the country.
It's interesting because, again, this was your job. You saw these cases come across your desk all the time. Now you do research for the novel. Did you learn anything in the process of doing the research?
Absolutely. If it came to my desk, it was the tip of the iceberg because, as you said, so many sex assaults are unreported. So the ones that I saw were really the rare ones. They were the outliers. I did absolutely learn some shocking statistics. Like, for example, did you know that fraternity boys are 300% more likely to rape than boys who don't join fraternities? I have two little boys, and this has made me really think about whether I would let them join a fraternity when they go to college.
Well, so you've done some education and some research for this particular novel. Anna Curtis has been with you for a while. Maybe we should remind our audience who she is and tell us a bit about her.
Sure. Anna Curtis is a D.C. sex crimes prosecutor, which may not come as a surprise. She holds the same job that I held, and she and I have been together for five books now. And in this book, in The Last Good Girl, she's charged with finding a young woman named Emily Shapiro who has disappeared from the fictional Tower University campus.
Tell us more about Emily.
Emily is actually the president of the university's daughter. And as Anna starts to look for her, she finds that both Emily's father and the whole university are hiding some pretty dark secrets about how they have handled sex assault cases on their campus.
Will you read for us?
Absolutely. This is a section from the first chapter. A raucous bunch of Beta Psi boys rounded the corner. Dylan was in front, of course. He was the alpha dog in any pack of males. Tall and swaggering, dressed in clothes that were both effortlessly casual and painfully expensive, he could be the poster boy for fratty privilege. The other guys clustered around him, vying for position. Emily froze a few feet from the entrance to Lucky's. Dylan's eyes locked on hers. He smiled, walked over, and stood in her space. Too close. The other boys formed a semicircle around her. She felt unsteady. "I don't want any trouble," she said. "Doesn't seem that way," Dylan drawled. "Seems like you're doing everything you can to stir the pot." One of Dylan's minions snorted, cocked back his head, and spat. His phlegm arced through the air, reflecting the light from the bar's neon signs, glittering and ugly. Everyone watched the loogie as it hung suspended for a moment at the top of its arc. Then it headed back down and splatted on her boot. The boy's laughter was loud and vicious. Anger pulsed through her gut, more acidic than any shot at Lucky's. "You are disgusting," she told Dylan, "and you can't even fight your own fights." Dylan frowned at his friends, and they stilled. Their silence was more ominous than their laughter. Emily was keenly aware that she could not control this situation. "Head in," Dylan told the other guys. "I'll be right there." "You sure, dude?" "Yeah." The boys did what they were told. Music pulsed and quieted as the bar's door swung open and shut. Emily tried to move away too, but Dylan's hand clamped onto her arm. They faced each other, a boy and a girl alone on an empty stretch of sidewalk, breathing fog into the night. "Have you thought about what you're doing?" he said. "Like, really thought about it? Because it's kind of crazy that this is how you want to play it." "I'm not playing." His finger squeezed her arm through the puffy coat. "You know what this means for you. You are done." "Oh, Dylan," she smiled. "I'm just beginning. I'm writing an editorial, too. It'll be in next week's Tower Times." "My family will end you," he said. "I know who your family is. And pretty soon, they'll know who you are, too."
That's Allison Liotta reading from her new novel, The Last Good Girl. She's going to be at the Barnes & Noble at Cary tonight at 7 o'clock. So tell us about this family, because privilege does play a part in this novel.
It does. Both the boy and the girl who are in this, who play a big role in this book, come from privileged families. And I think it's because a lot of the dynamics on the college campuses are not about the haves versus the have-nots that we traditionally think of in America, but the colleges versus the victims in many ways. And it doesn't really matter what kind of family you come from. It matters what has happened to you and how your college treats you as a result.
Well, you know, there's class privilege, of course, but then there's the fact of male privilege and the fact that male privilege and whose story is privileged and whose stories are not so much in the legal process. And that is far more pervasive even than class privilege when it comes to sex, this kind of thing.
I think so. There are far more girls that are sexually assaulted than boys. And if I think that were reversed, we might see different rules about how these are prosecuted. I think we might not see such a big backlog of rape kits. I think we might not see so many crimes being swept under the rug by colleges.
And the inclination not to believe the victim in this
yes.
case. This is a crime. And are there statistics that suggest that, or is it my imagination, that we are less inclined to believe victims in cases of sexual assault than in other crimes?
Oh, absolutely. It's something that I just saw as a prosecutor all the time. People often thought that the victim was likely to be making it up for some reason, attention or revenge, something like that. But the statistics are that survivors who come forward to report a sexual assault are just as likely to be lying about it as anyone, any crime victim who comes forward to report any crime, a mugging, your house being broken into, your car being carjacked. They're all, the rates of lying are exactly the same across the board.
And of course, you are focused on a college campus in this particular book and the novel and the story itself. And it turns out that in college campuses, there are some interesting statistics, too, particularly the red zone in mm-hmm. those first couple of weeks of college. Tell us about that and what you learned about it.
Yeah, that is the time, that first week when students first go to school, that week in September, and a disproportionate number of sex assaults happen in that week. I think it's because the kids are getting used to being out and about, alcohol, freedom, all of those things kind of put together, and they're vulnerable. They don't even know what the street name is that they're walking on. And predators know this, and predators are out to take advantage of that.
Another interesting statistic about at least assaults on campuses is the rate, sort of who the perpetrators
yes.
are.
I think there's this feeling that campus sex assaults, which are by and large acquaintance rapes, somebody you know, not somebody jumping out of the bushes, that these are sort of he said, she said, murky, alcohol-fueled, you know, buyer's regret sort of cases. And they're not. By and large, these are a very tiny group of young men who are committing the same crimes over and over. 6% of the sex assaults on campuses, 6% of the boys on campuses commit 90% of the assaults. So if you've been sexually assaulted by someone on campus, your perpetrator is likely to have done it before, and they're likely to do it again. It's not that there's this huge group of all boys you need to be scared of, but there's one very small group of boys that keep doing this.
Now, that suggests to me that there is less awareness of who. In other words, these are not necessarily partners, I would think, with 6% committing 90% of the crimes, some of these must be anonymous. No? Does that?
I don't think so. I think there's usually it's at least certainly on campuses and in most sex crimes, it's someone you know. And on campuses, it might be someone you know, not that well, it might not be your partner, but it might be that lacrosse star that you have a crush on that you've seen at a couple parties, or the guy who's leading the Greek council, you know, someone who you know and maybe trust a little bit because of his position.
That's interesting, too, because I know that campuses are doing all sorts of things, and it has mostly to do with awareness and taking sensitivity, various trainings and online trainings and all mm-hmm. of that reach the entire population, mm-hmm. all of which would be good to raise awareness. But if I knew that statistic, I would focus on the 6% and clean up 90% of my problem. Are college campuses doing that?
Right. Well, that's part of the problem is if something is swept under the rug, if that particular boy isn't going to be held responsible, he's going to keep doing it. He's going to commit crime after crime after crime. So we really can reduce the number of sex assaults on campuses if we are willing to actually adjudicate these cases. And in the past, the colleges have shown themselves not really willing to do that. They don't want to. They want to educate their students. They don't want to get in the business of they'd rather not see it. They'd rather not, you know that this is happening. And so what we've seen is over the past many decades, a lot of colleges have reported zero rapes on their campuses over and over, which I think is just, you know, outrageously wrong.
And this gets us to the underreporting. Well, what are some of the – there are some structural barriers, too. I mean, it may be that universities simply don't want to admit it. The publicity is bad. But you've also seen, especially from your perch as a prosecutor – some kind of structural barriers that make it more difficult for universities.
Sure, absolutely. And I think this is also where a good book comes in, because we have to talk about this. We have to, and I think a good story gets that going. But there are incentives. In any system, you have to look at what the incentives are. And for the colleges, their incentive is to not find the assault. A lot of survivors have come forward and said that they were disbelieved by the people they reported it to, that they were discouraged from coming forward, and even if they came forward, that their assailant was found not responsible. And then there's some cases where the guy was found responsible, but later he appealed and was allowed to come back on campus unbeknownst to the victim who had gone through that whole process.
And the penalties are more severe for a university that wrongfully dismisses a student than keeps a student on campus who maybe committed the crime.
That's right. Just another incentive for them.
The details in this book inspired by many cases around the country, including here at UNC. Tell us about that and what role that played.
So UNC has been such an interesting place for this. There's been such a huge movement of Title IX activists, these mostly young women coming forward to talk about how the university treated them, what happened to them, their assault, and then their treatment afterwards, which was almost more traumatic than the assault itself, as the treatment by their colleges. There are a couple girls who wrote this book called We Believe You about it's kind of a compilation of all different real-life stories from UNC and from other colleges around the country. Those two girls, are young women, are from UNC. I think UNC has gotten a lot of press for because these two young women are from there. But I have to say, I don't think that they're any worse than anyone else. I think the fact that we're hearing about it means they're actually paying a lot of attention to it.
As you said earlier, you should really focus on the ones with the low reported rates, because those are the ones sweeping it under the rug.
That's right.
The ones with all the attention, while there's work to be done, may need less attention at the moment. So you've distilled many of these cases across the country in your book. The Last Good Girl is the book we're talking about. Allison Liotta is the author, and I wonder if you could read for us another section, maybe set it up for us if you need
to. Sure, I would be happy to. This is a section from Emily's voice. Emily is gone for most of this book. She's disappeared. So I wondered how to give her a voice. And this is a vlog that she recorded, a video log on YouTube for one of her classes, and it allowed me to give her a chance to speak to the reader. This is immediately after her assault. I can't believe I'm the statistic. 1 in 5. It's like we all knew it. It's in half the videos they make you watch online before school starts. They say it over and over in orientation. 1 in 5 girls will be raped in college. We joked about it as we were getting ready, putting on lipstick, trying on outfits, giggling. Which one of us will it be? Ha ha ha, hilarious. And here I am. A few days ago, I was raped. Oh my God, did I just say that? It's insane. I can't get used to the words. I was raped? I'm a rape victim? This is not who I want to be. And I kind of wonder if I cannot be it by just not being it. If a tree falls in the woods and no one hears it, does it make a sound? If a girl is raped but no one knows, is she really a victim? I could just pretend it never happened. I'm sorry, wait, did I just say that? Ugh. I rolled my eyes at those girls in the videos, the ones who didn't report because they were torn or ashamed or thought it was their fault. Get it together. If you're mugged, you don't worry about whether you are asking for a mugging. Report it. Be strong. Move on. But here I am. Not sure I can bring charges. I'm not sure I can pretend it didn't happen either.
Allison Leota reading from her new novel, The Last Good Girl. She's going to be at Barnes & Noble in Cary tonight at 7 o'clock reading. So there's that, the tension even for victims. And in part, it gets back to this question. I mean, part of it is the difficulty of sort of identifying with the victim in this case, but also the fact that you might not be heard. It gets back to this or believed. And I'm wondering, in the course of writing this book, the Rolling Stone article came out, and the controversy over that unfolded. Maybe you should remind us what happened, but whether or not it played a role in sort of your putting this book together.
I was already kind of mid-book when the Rolling Stone article came out. And the Rolling Stone article has given me a lot of agita. And I think a lot of sex crimes prosecutors feel the same way. They reported that this woman reported a rape, a gang rape by a bunch of fraternity members and at UVA. And alleged that this had happened to her. And has since come out that the reporter didn't follow up, didn't check the sources, and that this assault may not have happened at all. And I think this goes to the point you were making before, Frank, that people tend to think that sex assault victims are making things up. And this, a story like this just reinforces that. It's just going to be that much harder because, you know, it's this kind of man bites dog sort of situation, but it's a very high profile one. And it's going to be every time a sex crimes prosecutor walks in to do an acquaintance rape from here on out, that, you know, that is going to be in the jury's mind.
Well, also in your book, you have we know that that Anna Curtis is our prosecutor. She's been doing that for a while. We meet a veteran named Cooper Bolden.
Yes.
Tell us about the addition of Cooper Bolden to this story.
Cooper is Anna's love interest. People are sometimes surprised that Anna has a romantic life, but she does. She's just like the rest of us. My friends and I who are in the prosecutor's office, we all were dating and getting married and having families while we were prosecuting sex crimes, which is kind of an interesting point of view to have. Cooper is Anna's boyfriend. He is an Afghan war vet who came home after an IED blast with one leg missing. And I based this on a young man who was in my neighborhood. I live in Washington, D.C., near Walter Reed Medical Hospital. And walking down the street or just the running paths, you see these wounded warriors who've come home missing an arm or a leg or what have you. And I was so inspired by their service and their just wondering what it was like for them coming home to reintegrate into their lives. So this young man, this real man in my neighborhood, Jonathan Mullen, was dating my babysitter, actually, and he had lost both of his legs in Afghanistan in an IED blast. And he was incredible with my kids, talking to them. You know, they would ask him, "What's up with your robot legs?" And he was so cool about just responding. And he said he actually preferred when people asked him about it rather than just staring and looking away. And I talked to Jonathan and my babysitter about what their life was like, you know, the PTSD, his dreams coming back. And his dream was to become a photographer. So I had him take my author photo, and that's what's on the back of my book. He did a lovely job.
The book is The Last Good Girl. The author is Allison Leota, and she will be at Barnes & Noble in Cary tonight at 7 o'clock. You can find out more about that at our website, stateofthings.org. Allison, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Frank.
Just ahead, we're going to talk about how painters in Myanmar are illustrating a country in a time of transition. We'll talk about that on The State of Things. Please stay with us.